The Institute.
Institute.
Institute for Justice.
The National Law Firm for Liberty.
Welcome to Deep Dive with the Institute for Justice. I'm Melanie Hildreth, and I'm here with IJ senior attorneys Rob Johnson and Bob McNamara. We're going to talk today about what happens when the government's ability to regulate occupations intersects with the First Amendment's protection of speech. I want to start our conversation by sharing a few comments from someone who's living and working at that intersection right now.
I do think the First Amendment protects my right to work with clients via teletherapy. I'm not averse to regulations, for example, that might prevent a professional or someone from misrepresenting their qualifications. I just don't think that the rules should be so arbitrary.
That was IJ client Elizabeth Brokamp. Rob, can you give some background on Elizabeth? Who is she and what arbitrary rules is she talking about in that clip?
So Elizabeth Brokamp is a Virginia licensed professional counselor. And what that means is that she's a therapist. She talks to people about their feelings, about what's going on in their life, and she tries to help people feel better. She's been working in that field for over 20 years. She has a master's degree. She's highly qualified, highly trained, and she's located in Northern Virginia. So during non-pandemic times, you know, she's a short drive across the Potomac from people in the district who could visit her in her offices in Virginia. And of course, that's perfectly legal because she is licensed in Virginia. But what's happened during the pandemic is, like many mental health professionals, she has moved all of her therapy on the internet. So she's talking to her clients over video chat applications that are very much like the ones that we're using to talk right now. That's been a lifesaver for her and for many other people in the mental health professions. but unfortunately, that's also brought her into contact with a whole thicket of licensing rules. Because in the district, if she talks to a person in their DC home over the internet, she's engaged in the practice of professional counseling in DC. And she's not licensed in DC. And she actually reached out to the DC licensing board and she said, you know, can I talk to people in the district during the pandemic without a DC license? And they told her no. So she's been contacted by people in DC who have heard about her practice, who want her to work with her, and who think that she can help them. And she's reached out to DC and said, can I help these people? And they've told her no. So, if you talk to Elizabeth, what she'll tell you is she views herself as a helper, somebody who wants to help people. And of course, this is a time of just unprecedented need for mental health services. These are people who she thinks that she can help. And yet, because of DC's licensing laws, she's had to turn those people away.
Now, is that true of someone who had been an existing patient of hers, or does it apply to anyone in DC or only to people who are just now maybe seeking help and had her referred to them or something like that?
So in the district, there is currently, because of COVID, an exemption for existing patients. And this is, you know, sort of part of the issue really is it's a patchwork of different laws that vary from state to state. So, you know, in some states during the pandemic, there's no exemption for existing patients. In the district, they've adopted a temporary COVID exemption for existing patients, which of course then raises the question of, you know, if it's okay for someone to talk to an existing patient who, by the way, has to have been previously living outside the district but have moved back to the district during the pandemic, which is sort of an oddly narrow circumstance. If that's okay, then why can't somebody take on a new patient? And then, of course, there are other states that have enacted even broader waivers that allow new patients during the pandemic, and then others that have enacted no waivers at all. So, and it's really very hard for someone like Elizabeth even to really know what's legal in one state to another or one jurisdiction to another, much less comply with all of those different laws.
It's very much in the realm of licensing, but in my introductory remarks and then in Elizabeth's comments, we talked about the First Amendment. So can you talk a little bit about how the First Amendment comes into play in Elizabeth's circumstance?
Yeah. So, basically what Elizabeth does is she talks to people. She talks to people about their feelings, about what's going on in their lives. That's really what therapy is. It's speech. It's two people sitting down and having a conversation. And, you know, of course, under the First Amendment, the government can't prohibit unauthorized talking. And I think that's even more vivid in Elizabeth's case, because literally all she wants to do in the district is talk, right? Like anything that she's physically doing, which is not much, to be candid, she's sitting there and talking to someone. But anything that she's physically doing is happening in Virginia, where she's a fully licensed professional counselor. And all she wants to do in the district is talk to people over the internet. And our basic claim at a sort of 50,000 foot level is, you know, the government can't prohibit unauthorized talking.
And that, I think, is a huge distinction in this case and in kind of how people think about the government regulation of medical services. There's a huge difference between the government regulating whether someone can write you a prescription, say, that gives you access to a controlled substance. Like if someone writes you a prescription for medical marijuana that gives you the legal right to access marijuana, versus someone saying, you know, I think you might feel better if you use some marijuana. The first is giving someone access to a controlled substance. The second is just giving someone ordinary advice about how to live their life, which is something all of us do. We've been on the receiving end of that our entire lives, and all of us give advice like that. And the idea that the government can actually make it illegal just to give that kind of ordinary life advice without the government's advance permission is I think, a striking assertion of power that just kind of gets folded into this idea that, of course, only licensed doctors can write prescriptions.
Well, yeah, and that's really, if you look at the details of DC's licensing law, I mean, it's just, it's the way it's written is just staggeringly broad. I mean, if you read the law, it basically says, you know, if you talk to anybody to, quote, facilitate human development and identify and remediate mental, emotional, or behavioral conditions and associated difficulties, then
that's
you
parenting.
Have to have this. Yeah. Then you have to have this license. And that even includes just helping someone to, quote, achieve long-term effective mental, emotional, physical, spiritual, social, educational, or career development. I mean, that basically, you know, if you talk to your friend about a problem in their life, or you talk to a, you know, a minister or somebody who heads an AA group or a Weight Watchers group. I mean, there's all kinds of different people, you know, and there's also an entire, you know, group of people, they call themselves life coaches, and they have no, you know, many of them have no training or particular expertise, but they call themselves life coaches and they provide what amounts to therapy for people. And, you know, DC is basically claiming the ability to regulate all of that speech, which would be just a staggeringly broad assertion of power. And of course, the reality, though, is that DC doesn't actually apply it as broadly as it's written, which then leads to sort of another weird feature of the law, which is that even though it's written so broadly, it's really only enforced against people who have the kind of specialized training and expertise that Elizabeth has, which then creates this weird paradox where the more educated you are, the more trained you are in providing therapy, the greater the regulatory burdens that DC is subjecting you to. So, you know, if somebody who doesn't have Elizabeth's training or expertise can hang out their shingle as a life coach, but then somebody who does has to get this license. And so the result is that the very reason that people are seeking out Elizabeth's help is actually what's subjecting her to greater regulation in the district.
And when it comes to things like qualifications, Elizabeth made the comment that she doesn't want people to misrepresent themselves. So, I mean, I guess misrepresenting yourself is also just talking. So how does that come into play when you look at this from a First Amendment perspective?
So I think there's a difference between how you go about advertising what you're selling and what you're actually selling. And so if I claim that if you come talk to me, I'm going to make you grow 3 inches and my advice is going to, you know, make you a number one pick in the next NFL draft, I'm making claims about what I'm selling. And if those are false claims, then I'm engaged in fraud. I'm defrauding you. I can't actually do those things. I'm falsely claiming what I can do. But that's different from me accurately telling you what I can do, which is, look, I'm a guy who has never played organized football. But if you want, I'm happy to give you the best advice I can on how to be a number one NFL draft pick. And if you, for whatever reason, think that's something worth listening to, the underlying advice is simply pure speech. And so if the government wants to regulate how people can sell themselves, that make it illegal to say that you're a licensed counselor when you're not, to make it illegal to say that you've received an advanced degree when you haven't, that's regulating fraud. That's entirely different from a set of rules that's designed to restrict who can talk in the first place. Fundamentally, the idea here is that in this country, we rely on people to decide who they want to listen to. We don't rely on the government to decide who's going to get to speak. And so as long as people are being honest about who they are and what their credentials are, the decision about whether to listen to them is up to individual audience members, is up to individual people who decide whether this is the sort of advice they think might help them. And laws like the ones Elizabeth is bumping up against get that principle exactly wrong. They say there's no amount of disclosure Elizabeth can do, no matter how honest she is about who she is, what her credentials are, and what she can do. She is just not allowed to say these things because she is not the sort of person DC has decided should be allowed to say these sorts of things.
So yeah, with an occupation like Elizabeth's, how do you then look at, how do you balance the potential different ways to regulate what it is that she's doing? Is there something maybe less than this full-on license that makes it impossible for her to talk via Zoom to somebody who happens to be in a different state, which is just crazy, but that also shows that she's not... like me, for example, just trying to give you some advice that's maybe not worth all that much.
Well, yeah. So I think this really gets at the difference between licensing and certification, which is a distinction that's just hugely important for all of these different licensure laws. I mean, so, you know, licensing basically means if you don't have the piece of paper from the government, you can't engage in something at all. You can't talk at all without a license. And certification means essentially, the government creates a title, and the government can't claim a title that kind of has its own independent existence, like psychologist, but the government can create a new title, like licensed, you know, Virginia licensed counselor, for instance, would be a good one. They can say, and if you don't have this piece of paper from the government, you can't call yourself a Virginia certified counselor. And then they can create qualifications that you have to have, courses that you have to take, a test that you have to pass, you know, whatever qualifications that they want. And if you don't have those qualifications, then you can't use that title. And that provides many of the, you know, people say are the benefits of licensing, essentially that you know if somebody uses this title that they have a certain sort of baseline level of qualifications. But it doesn't exclude people from the marketplace who, you know, may have a different, come at things from a different angle, and yet have something valuable to say.
And I do think that really matters. Like, I happen to believe that, you know, professional training and counseling is useful and that there's a very good reason to want to talk to a professional counselor rather than just pour your heart out to a bartender. But it's worth thinking about what the situation would be if it weren't useful. Like, imagine that the government, instead of requiring a degree in counseling, said we're going to require a $10,000 fee for our counselor license. It's very important that people retain the right to go to potential clients and say, look, I'm not a licensed professional counselor, and here's why I'm not, and here's why you shouldn't care about that credential. That people need to be able to evaluate whether the credential is a thing they care about rather than give the government the power just to, in advance, silence people that it doesn't think should be talking.
So going back to the idea that, you know, at its heart, what Elizabeth is doing is just talking. And as you described, Rob, there are a lot of professions that potentially could fall under this because they too involve talking. So you've got pastors, you've got life coaches, you have the professional counselor. And then, you know, on the other end, you have maybe a lawyer. Given that range of kinds of speech, you know, that people can engage in for a living, how does the law, does the way that the law treats these different occupations change depending on what the occupation is and what the kind of speech is?
Well, that's a A great question, because it really gets at what's something called the professional speech doctrine. And, you know, the reality is that it shouldn't change. You know, speech is speech, and it shouldn't really matter whether you're, you know, talking about one topic or the other. But there has been a lot of confusion in the doctrine, and it really goes back to an opinion by former Justice, Justice White, in a case called Lowe versus SEC. And in this opinion, Justice White suggests that there's something called the professional speech doctrine, and that speech is entitled to less protection if it's speech by a quote-unquote professional talking to somebody in a professional relationship. It's kind of an odd doctrine for a number of reasons. I mean, one, you know, who is a professional? You know, is, you know, how do you draw that line? It turns out to be quite difficult. I mean, you know, you have some courts that draw it extremely broadly, saying someone like a fortune teller is a professional. You know, it becomes very hard to sort of say who gets that sort of who falls
who gets the designation.
It doesn't, right? And then you know, the other problem is just there's really no reason in the First Amendment that speech should be entitled to less protection just because it's speaking to a smaller audience. I mean, you know, the example that I'm going to steal from Bob that Bob likes to give is you know, if you give a talk about a book. And then at the end of the talk, you talk to people in the audience. It's not like you have less First Amendment protection when you're talking to people after the talk than you do when you're giving the talk itself. So, you know, it's a very odd doctrine. And actually, it's sort of an interesting thing because it comes up in this Lowe versus SEC case, which held that the SEC couldn't prohibit somebody's speech. You know, and Justice White is writing this concurrence, and he's basically philosophizing about, you know, potential exceptions to the First Amendment, but he didn't actually say that anybody in that case didn't have a First Amendment right. So it's just basically pure dicta that gets picked up by the lower courts and used to quash a huge amount of speech.
Oh, and that's it's a weird thing about how the law develops, because the Supreme Court never touched Justice White's concurrence in Lowe v. SEC. The Supreme Court never said this is right. It never once favorably cited Justice White's concurrence in Lowe v. SEC. But the lower courts just latched onto it and said this must be the law, even though it wasn't the law. And spun out this entire doctrine where people in positions like professionals, people who had a great deal of moral authority, somehow got less First Amendment protection, which is, I mean, as Rob says, it seems exactly backwards as a matter of just free speech philosophy, that like we shouldn't be protecting speech less because it's more persuasive. It seems insane to say, oh, you're a doctor, you're a lawyer, people are going to be so persuaded by your speech that you must be outside the First Amendment. When usually we think about the First Amendment as a tool to protect useful, persuasive speech, but it's also a doctrine that just ran completely off the rails. I mean, we had one case where the state of Kentucky had sent a cease and desist letter to our client for engaging in the unauthorized, unlicensed practice of psychology for writing an advice column, a newspaper advice column, like a Dear Abby style question and answer. And they said, oh, that's personal advice. That puts your newspaper column within the professional speech doctrine. And so it was this idea that just went completely off the rails and threatened, frankly, to swallow a huge swath of what is the most important speech. Like in your day-to-day life, it's certainly all well and good that people can march in the streets and carry signs advocating for or against whatever they want. But in your actual life, in the decisions you make on a day-to-day basis, they're not influenced by people carrying signs in the street. They're influenced by these sorts of one-on-one communications that were suddenly getting sucked out of the First Amendment entirely.
So, Bob, can you, if it starts, as Rob says, just as dicta, and ends with the court saying, okay, this is the unlicensed practice of psychology, even though it's a newspaper column published, you know, not speaking to anyone in particular, just giving this person's thoughts, what were there some seminal cases that brought it there? Did it just sort of happen in the lower courts kind of in a soupy way over time? Or how did we get from the first place to where we were in that case with the psychologist, the newspaper columnist being charged with being a psychologist?
So really a lot of what happened is if you if you give lower courts a tool to avoid applying the Constitution, they will grab it in every possible instance. And that's really what happened with the professional speech doctrine, is that you would have laws that had a certain ideological valence, and it was people on both the left and the right, where there would be laws restricting sort of gay conversion therapy, which is, you know, a therapy that's widely condemned and is known to not work, but applying it strictly to talk therapy with adults. And rather than go through the analysis of saying, on the facts, is this sufficiently dangerous that the government can ban it, courts reached for the professional speech doctrine so they could say, ah, we don't have to do any of the hard analysis. We don't have to look at your studies. We can just say this is outside the First Amendment. And the, kind of the same thing happened in the opposite ideological direction, where Florida passed a law making it illegal for doctors to ask their patients whether they owned guns. And it was fueled by this fear that, you know, doctors were going to be sort of using their moral authority to intimidate people out of being gun owners. But again, it's just talking. And doctors said, why can't I ask the question? And instead of going through the analysis, the temptation for the courts was to say, ah, you're a medical doctor. You're outside the First Amendment. We get an analytical get out of jail free card. And sucked up in that was a lot of economic regulation, where what courts want to do when they're faced with an economic regulation is say, this isn't our job. We don't do economic regulations. And so you had cases like that of Dr. Ron Hines in Texas, which was, you know, one of our cases, where Dr. Hines set up a website and just sent people emails. People could send him an email about their pets, and he would just give them advice. And sometimes his advice was, you need to go see a veterinarian. Sometimes his advice was different, but he would get emails from people in rural areas who didn't have access to a veterinarian. He got an email once from a guy who was working on an oil rig, who had a dog with him and wanted to know why his dog was making a noise. And Dr. Hines just sent emails. Everyone knew what they were getting. It was pure advice. But the state of Texas initially successfully said, wait. Dr. Hines is a veterinarian. He's a professional. That means he doesn't have the right to send these emails, which I think is the perfect illustration of how pernicious this doctrine became. Because under Texas law, it was perfectly legal for me to send you an email about your dog, even though, you know, I'm just some jerk. I don't know why your dog's making a noise. But it was a crime for Dr. Hines, who actually has useful advice to give you, to send you that email. And, you know, if anyone's going to be outside the First Amendment, it should be the jerk who doesn't know what he's talking about. But the professional speech doctrine said it was the other way around.
Yeah. So, sort of I think lurking in this whole doctrine is this idea that somehow speech gets less protection if you're being paid to speak. And the courts never say that, but it's kind of lurking there as almost like a prejudice that I think some lawyers and judges may have. And I think, I mean, it's important to realize, right, that some of the speech that we all realize is, you know, central to the First Amendment is speech that people are paid to do, right? Like journalists are paid to talk. Actors are paid to talk. Artists are paid to talk. You know, even politicians are paid to talk. So if you had a rule that, oh, well, just because you're paid, suddenly your speech falls outside the First Amendment wouldn't be worth very much to anybody at all at that point.
And it seems like it's easy to understand perhaps why they did this sort of shorthand with if it's something that you're paid to do, or if it seems like it's extra persuasive, or it's like, oh, it's a profession where you were educated a lot. Because the line between speech and conduct in those kinds of occupations does seem to be less clear. So when there are occupations like veterinarian, for example, or doctor, or maybe lawyer, where there is some conduct that is tied to the relationship that the person has with the client or the person who's paying them. What is the right way to look at the regulations and restrictions on what a person can say in those contexts?
So I think the key thing to understand here, and sort of the key intellectual move to make, is to understand that the First Amendment is a restriction on government. It's not a grant of rights to us. It's a restriction on government. And so the question you have to ask when you're applying the First Amendment is, what is the government doing? Is the government restricting speech, or is it restricting conduct? And the Supreme Court has actually been very clear about how you do this. You look at the government regulation, And you say, if the government regulation applies on the basis of your communicating a message, that is a restriction on speech. And the way that plays out is some things that these professions do are conduct. If the government's restricting a doctor from writing a prescription, the government regulation doesn't care whether I look at the prescription. The prescription could be in an envelope. I never open it. I just take it to a pharmacy and exercise the legal right he's given me to acquire the controlled substance that he's prescribed. That's not restricting. That doesn't apply based on the doctor communicating a message. So too, if I write a contract for someone, or if I establish a legal entity, I write documents that create a corporation for you, and I hand them to you, and I say, now you are Melanie Hildreth, LLC. You never have to read them. If you never read them, the legal effect is the same. I've created this legal entity. That's not a restriction on my communicating a message. But if all I say is, here's what I think about your situation. Here's some advice. You seem sad. Maybe you should talk to somebody. You seem a little low energy. Maybe you need to get more sunlight. You're really annoying. Maybe you need a nap, which is what I say to my kids all the time. All of that is just pure speech. And if a government regulation hinges on the fact that I said those things, then it's a restriction on my speech. And it's a very simple, straightforward, easy to apply rule that prevents the government from sort of leveraging its overall power to regulate into a power to control who can or cannot say this or that.
So with that framework, going back to Elizabeth, what is the rule of law that we want in her case? What is the perfect world if Rob prevails and Elizabeth is freed? What does the world look like now? And how is it better for her? How is it better for other people? And then how will other people be able to move through that world as counselors or speakers?
I think what we're working towards and what the world would look like is essentially a certification regime, which is what we were talking about earlier. You know, certainly the government would be able to say, if you're going to call yourself a licensed psychiatrist or a licensed psychologist or a licensed counselor, like, here are the credentials that you have to have. But the government can't say that only certain people with certain credentials can talk to other people about their feelings and give advice about, how to deal with problems in their lives or feel better. And in some ways, that is the world we live in already, because like I said, I don't think anybody really thinks that they can monopolize who can talk to other people about their feelings, which is why you do have unlicensed, life coaches or other people who are offering services that really fall within the definition of counseling, for instance. But what would change would be that, somebody who, like Elizabeth, who is qualified, would be able to talk in any state without having, a special license from that state. She would just have to be honest about what she's doing and say, look, I'm licensed in Virginia. I'm not licensed in DC, but if you want to talk to me and work with me, I'd love to work with you. And that's honest. It's straightforward. And the government wouldn't be able to stop her from talking to her clients. I think I touched on this earlier, but it's important to realize too, this isn't just DC, right? This is states all across the country that have these types of laws. And the burden here on Elizabeth and on her clients isn't just DC. It's, a client might move out of the DC area for a job, or someone might go off to college and might want to continue working with Elizabeth. And she can't do that if they're moving to a state where she can't talk. So what we're working towards is a regime where Elizabeth can talk to her clients wherever they're located. If they're out of the district for a week, if they're out of the district for, a weekend, or if they move for the rest of their life, she should be able to talk to people wherever they are, because the First Amendment applies across the entire country, and her right to talk is nationwide, and her right to talk doesn't depend on sort of artificial geographic boundaries between different states.
With that, we're out of time. Thank you both for your thoughts and insights, and thanks to everyone for joining us for today's deep dive. If you enjoyed this episode, you can get more wherever you get your podcasts or on YouTube. And don't forget to subscribe.